to season 4, episode 3 of the SBEP team podcast. You're, of course, here with me, Mr. Southwell. Mr. Nash, good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Doyle, good morning.
Hello, everybody.
And as we promised last week, we've got ourselves our very first guest of the new season. We've got Richard Norman from Sports Leaders. You're the chief executive, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
So we've got a really big history with the Sports Leaders organisation. We run lots of those qualifications at the school. Mr. Doyle, do you want to talk very quickly about our role in that in PE?
Absolutely. We have had literally hundreds of students going through from year 9 all the way through to year 12 and 13 who have qualified as sports leaders students. They undertake the sports leaders level 1 and 2 at Key Stage 4 and then go on some of them to do the level 3, which has even got some UCAS points attached, which helps out with university. And I'm not exaggerating when I say literally hundreds in the last 5 years or so. We've put so many students through it because it is such a worthwhile experience, learning all about how to communicate better, be resilient, problem solve, have confidence in themselves and be able to show that. And as we always say, sport is a brilliant training ground to be able to actually get things wrong, get things right, and then develop those skills.
So really important for us as a school, and we champion the work they do a lot. It's really important to our students as well. Let's find out how everyone's getting on. Mr. Nash, how's it been last week or so?
Yeah, very much the same. It's been very good. Weather's been lovely, so that's helped with the family, being outside a lot. Lots of different activities, led mainly by my wife. She's the creative one. I am the follower. And so she comes up with the ideas. I go out there and just join in. But, you know, staying active is still an important part for us. We're still taking part in Joe Wicks, still doing our own little bit of circuit training in the garden or going out for walks and things. But, you know, very much the same. There's not a lot's changed in the last week.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a slow one. Mr. Doyle, what about you?
Yeah, so I sort of briefly mentioned that we were in a position where we were having to sort of really self-isolate last week. Everything's cleared up okay. But what has been nice is, as we've been able to go out and get that time to go and do our exercise again, we've really...
That's our first ever technical hitch there, and Mr. Doyle has actually cut out. So I think we carry on without him for a little bit. Richard, what about you? How's it been for you? Because obviously you've got a very different role to us from where you sit.
Yeah, it's been really interesting, and loads of kind of positives and negatives. But broadly speaking, it's just an unusual time for everyone. So, you know, a big part of my role as for you guys in your capacity within the school is going to be about, actually, how do you manage change? How do you manage the unpredicted? But pretty much no one's come up. No one who I've spoken to in the past 4 weeks predicted a global pandemic that's going to cut down schooling and all the kind of community organisations and the social isolation and social distancing that we've had in the past 4 weeks. So for me, there's been a lot of positives, as I already mentioned. Normally, my role means I'm around and about. I'm doing lots of miles in the car. I'm in trains, going to meetings, and we found that actually being able to video conference is ideal for actually allowing us to. I can get far more done in a day. I can meet more people. We can actually be more reactive. It's easier to get meetings with people because you're not trying to align when you're going to be in the same place at the same time. But then still, you know, all of the challenges of working from home all the time. I've got a little basement office that I work out of, and while I'm often in here one day a week, maybe, you know, being in here every day for 12 hours a day for the past 4 or 5 weeks now, because my son was unwell and we had to sort of socially isolate before the actual lockdown happened. So it's been interesting. But the great thing for me is seeing how people adapt to it and building that resilience, seeing that across centres that we work with, schools like yourselves, how they're adapting, how they're trying to make sure that pupils and young people that they engage with are still developing those personal skills that we see as critical at any time, and actually probably even more so at this time. So it's been, you know, can't deny that it's been a challenging time in many, many ways, but actually seeing how people are adapting to it is quite inspirational, if I'm being honest.
It's been really good to see that, and obviously we're recording this on a Friday, we've just come off the back of another clap for NHS. Those things are getting bigger and bigger every week, and I find that something that's really bringing everybody together, which has been really good.
Yeah, we had one, I live a few hundred metres away from the fire station, and they really went to town with the old sirens and everything, to the point whereby I'd slightly forgotten that the 8 o'clock thing was happening, and it scared the living daylights out of me when the fire station started going for it. I completely agree with you. It's nice to have that sense of community and that sense of support, and really appreciating what some people are doing, and you know, teachers are at the front line of that, as well as care workers and everything else in really kind of keeping things ticking along during this sort of unusual time for everybody, really. So, yeah.
Well, Cecil, I was going to say, thank you for being our first guest on for this season as well. We were just going to try and get a bit of a background, really, about your role. But can you tell us a bit about sports leaders as a whole, how far across the country you work and the numbers you work with?
Yeah, sure. I'll try to keep it relatively brief because there's always the danger of me going off into a long, long explanation. But we've been around for the best part of 40 years, and really we're all about developing personal leadership and life skills through sport and through other activities. We're constantly developing in other ways to support people to develop those personal skills, which are intrinsic to their kind of future development and their future opportunities of young people, how they can build their employability, how they can look to really progress on the journey that they want to. So I suppose the major difference with the work we do is not looking at it from there's a beginning and an end point. It's kind of there's a constant journey, and there's kind of peaks and troughs in how well that journey goes, but that's all part of the learning process. So we currently work with about 1,800 centres across the UK. So a centre for us can be anything from yourselves, Shelleybrook End, to we work with Manchester United Foundation, colleges, universities, councils, partnerships, a whole array of schools, colleges, community organisations. And we also work with, we also actually work in about 40 countries. We recently sort of did a little bit of a poll and figured out that actually we've got courses and centres in 40 countries around the world. So that's been great for us. But actually, our primary focus on the UK is on working in the UK. Each year we work with, through those centres, we work with about 110,000, 120,000 young people. And those young people, from the figures that we're aware of and can sort of quantify, they go through about 2 million hours of learning and about a further 1 million hour of volunteering as part of the course. And we know that once going through the courses that we do, about 80% of them want to go and do more in their local community. And from what we can quantify, they go out and deliver about another 1.3 million hours of volunteering in their local community. So the big thing for us is about building these kind of local role models who develop their personal skills and then go out into the community and create a kind of positive future for not just themselves, but also for the people around them. So we see this kind of this whole point of leadership is having this multiplier effect and helping others around you to also come on that journey with you. And we really like the kind of local role model kind of angle. It's about young people being empowered to go and positively influence their future and the future around them, however they see that. And we think sports leadership is just a great way to get that across to young people, get them engaged in a topic that they're engaged with. But we also find that it engages young people who perhaps aren't the sportiest person in the world, but can still remain involved in sport in some way and have a really positive, active contribution towards it. And so we see that as hugely beneficial, not just for personal skills and the kind of, you know, problem solving, communication, self-belief, self-management, teamwork that we build our qualifications and courses around, but actually about their own mental health, their own mental well-being, their resilience, all of these things that are critical to your future. So yeah, that's the kind of scope and scale of the work we do, really.
So I can say a very big outreach for you guys, which is massive. We obviously sort of know you guys from the sports side of things originally. And I'm just looking at Mr. Nash and Mr. Doyle. How many of you guys did level one or level two sports leaders back at school?
I'm trying to think if I did have that opportunity in my school. I don't think we did have that opportunity. I did my A-level PE, but possibly I don't remember being offered that at my school. But I know as soon as I went into my teacher training, to university, in my first school I found out all about those qualifications, and they were one of the first things that the PE team were talking about developing and getting you trained up ready to go and lead those courses in the future.
Yeah. I remember doing level one in, I think it might have been year nine. which would have been a long time ago now. This is going to be the ultimate test of our technical issues, if Mr. Doyle can answer that question as well.
I think I'm back. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah, we can now.
Fantastic. Apologies for the crash. Yeah, no, I did. It was called something slightly different, though, back at that time. Don't know, was it a Junior Sports Leader Award or something similar? Yeah. So, yeah, I definitely did a level one, and level two was on offer, I think, the year that I left. But you can just see how long it's been running for. And as Rick says, it's really important for the progress and the journey. I know having led the qualification at Shenley for quite a while, the volunteering part of it is absolutely enormous. The students absolutely love getting out there into the community and being able to go out and meet new people, be able to test their skills, and be able to play a big part in what's going on locally, especially in primary schools, but in other areas as well. It's a great, great experience for them.
I think I might have to go and dig out my my Burgundy record of achievements, check if I did do anything. Not everyone will know that.
No, and if anybody knows what that is, they're of a certain age, I think.
You know, the thing is that pops up so often. I did my Community Sports Leadership Award when I went to college, went to Luton Sixth Form College and did day level PE, and alongside that did my Community Sports Leadership Award. And it, you know, it was something that you went and your PE teacher said, do you want to do this? And you sort of went, yeah, fine, it's Tuesday afternoon, I'll do it. You know, it's not, we know that young people don't necessarily find it. It's actually reliant upon their teachers knowing that this is a good programme for them and delivering it for pupils. And we're fine with that. We want to reach as many young people as possible. And we're not hugely brand-centric. You know, we don't have a huge ego that comes with this. It's the learning that's the important thing rather than them knowing about us. But there's barely a week that goes past that we don't have someone say, I think I did one of those in a meeting. And I was in Switzerland with some friends a little while ago when I took on this job, and I was talking to a guy who's now a ski instructor in Switzerland for half of the year, a ski instructor in New Zealand for half of the year, and I was talking to him about this new job, and he said, I think I did one of those. 3 weeks later, I got a little photograph of his certificate that he still had probably 20 years later. And he was saying, I did do one. He still got it in the Burgundy Record of Achievement. And he was saying for him, the school that he was at didn't offer the kind of sporting activities he was really engaged with, but he actually realised that he could lead people, and that then got him engaged, and then from that he's built up this sort of ski instructor and has this amazing lifestyle of going between New Zealand and Switzerland for 6 months of the year each, you know. So over the course of that sort of 40 years we've been around, we know we've worked with about 1.8 million people, so it's a big old reach that we've had in that time, but some people will be very aware they've got a certificate, others won't, but we try and make sure it's the learning that's the important thing.
It was one of those things we really hit home on the sports side of things, but recently we've been focusing on some of those wider skills that students have and taking outside of the sports side of things, and I was really impressed to see the Raising Resilience stuff come out online. It's something that we're going to look potentially to roll out to some of our students as well. What was your thinking behind bringing that out? Because the timing of it obviously is superb for what's going on at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the current situation and coronavirus, it's changed the landscape for everyone, you know. And we operate as a training charity, so you know we work with schools, and you buy our training and our resources, and then we reinvest any surpluses into keeping costs low or redeveloping new activities or new resources that we can help support young people. But fundamentally, it means that for us, you know, the income switch has been switched off overnight because schools aren't there. They don't quite know what their delivery is going to be like. They don't know what their budgets are going to be like, what schools are going to be like when they return. And so, you know, you guys will be so much closer than I am. You're doing so much planning about theoretical and so much unknowns. And we kind of had a look at it and said, well, look, you know, what can we do in this time? We know that we want to support our centres as proactively as possible. We know that people that are engaged with us really want to make sure that young people have got something to do. And it seemed more crucial than ever that this whole point around resilience and really recognising that, yes, it's a bad situation, but how do we make the most of it? How are we going to come out of it thriving in the future was critical. So we actually started developing the Raising Resilience resource, knowing that this global pandemic was coming. but not quite sure of what the impact would be. We were initially thinking this would be schools shut down for maybe 4 to 6 weeks either side of the Easter break. And so we were kind of thinking, how can we support teachers like you guys to get a resource out to the young people during that time where they might not be able to participate in normal activity? And so we redeveloped the whole of the Raising Resilience resource and made that available for free for every centre that we work with at the moment. In the past few weeks, we've actually then taken that a stage further. We've realised and looked at some research into what sort of national emergencies and sort of crisis of this scale, the impact it can have on young people. And one of the biggest things that came out of Harvard University looking at interruption to education of interruption to education caused by natural disasters, things like hurricanes and so on. An interruption causes this thing called toxic stress, or can cause this thing called toxic stress, both for pupils but also for teachers. And so we've looked at that and sort of thought, what could we do? And so we've obviously had the Raising Resilience program that we've launched. We launched a couple of weeks back now. We've had such amazing, we had no opportunity to do all the market research, the testing that we would normally do. We just had to trust our gut and kind of put something out there. And we've been so impressed and inspired by the responses we've got, how people have used that resource. We've then used the time since launching that to rebuild a completely new program called I Can, I Am Resilience Program, which is really specific to the current situation and allowing a bit more adaptability. And that builds on that Raising Resilience module and looks at how we can support young people in particular through the current crisis and make a positive future for themselves. So it's all been sort of, at the point we started developing that Raising Resilience module, there was no way we thought that this was going to be schools interrupted for this period of time. We thought it was going to be a short-term module that would help just teachers to keep young people engaged for a period of interruption. But from that, we've built a whole program of activity that we're now will be ready to launch from early next week, which is sort of 10. It's training for teachers. It's a series of 10 bite-sized activities that can either be delivered at home or can be delivered in school if schools do start to have a phased return. And then all leading to really understanding what young people can make the most of the skills and the situation that they've got, recognising it's not ideal, but what are the positives they can take out of it, and how can they create a positive future for themselves and really support the idea of re-socialising communities. You know, for young people, this is not just about losing their school and their sort of their peers within a school setting. It's all those social activities that they're likely to undertake as well, you know, whether that be in a sports setting or non-sports setting, that's all been taken away. So we're kind of really keen to encourage young people to think, what's the positive I can make when things do return to normal? Or actually, how do I make the best of the current situation and really support what we're calling this kind of personal pledge and becoming community builders, whether that community be a school, a sports club, you know, a dance group, or just a bunch of mates just seeing all the time. I suspect you guys might be like me, where we probably make more time for our friends through video calling and you know, house party and all these kind of things that you've been able to jump on. And I've seen my friends more in the last 4 or 6 weeks than I have in the last 2 or 3 years, I suspect.
It's living resilience, isn't it? Because resilience itself is a word that a lot of students don't necessarily understand, although it's becoming more and more that teachers are looking to try to actually develop that as a skill as well as the academic. But resilience itself, quite often, if you ask a student, what does it mean? They'll be able to tell you the standard theory, such as, you know, it's about determination and it's about making sure that you don't give up. But actually living it in this situation now, it's important for students to understand how to put that theory into practice and understand the feelings and the emotional side of what's happening to them at the moment, and then use the skills. Having had a look at the Raising Resilience very briefly, I know, Mr. Southwell, you've looked at it a little bit more in depth, but it looks fantastic because it gives some really good real-life examples of where people have shown resilience, but it also gives some tools and some different strategies for people to be able to go through. If they're feeling low one day, feeling like they're a little bit trapped, it's about how do you actually demonstrate that resilience? What kind of processes do you and your mind go through to be able to overcome things? And again, I always think back to sport. And it's about on the football pitch or on the netball court or on the basketball court or, you know, Tokyo 2021, as it will be. where people are feeling nervous, anxious, feeling the competitive stress, how can they then use that resilience that they've maybe built up over time to be able to overcome those things and be the very best in terms of performance that they can be? And it all links in brilliantly. It's a great, great little scheme.
I think really good, because it's very on point, very on topic, but also the resilience thing really comes through in the resources, but also working with your family at home as well. There's lots of information about interactive, as like interviewing family members, I've seen as one of the tasks on there as well. And I'm looking at you guys as the parents of our podcast team. That's something you can genuinely do at home. It's really good.
Yeah, we've made it specific to the current situation. There was no point in our mind of creating something that you know, was talking about just theory. Actually, put it into practice, and you know, like we were saying just before we started on recording the podcast, you know, actually, there's been a lot of positives out of this. You know, there's when you can start seeing that, yes, we've had this interruption, that's out of my control, I can't do anything about that. What can I do? I can respond in the best way possible, and that's always about managing the things that you can influence, and you can influence positively, and recognizing the kind of skills that you've got to make that positive influence. So the where we've got the race resilience program and the I can I am resilience program, you know, this is breaking resilience down. It's not a sort of it's not something that is sort of this mysterious thing that you can't access. It's about how do you stay, you know, we've broken it down into 10 things. You know, how do you stay connected, how do you stay motivated, how do you think differently, what are the strengths of working in teams, how do you build your confidence, where can you work with communities, how can you support others, whether that's your family members or your friends or your brothers, your sisters, whomever it might be, recognise where they might be struggling and see how you might be able to have a positive impact on them. And it's all and so it's not just in relation to yourself, it's in relation to others. You know, I'm sure listeners will recognise that, you know, there's a huge challenge on their parents to maybe managing full-time work with childcare all of a sudden, and trying to support that learning of young people at home as well. They're all challenging things, but there's probably some positives come out of it. You know, they might be able to, you might see your parents more often. You might be able to grab that 5 or 10 minutes over a cup of tea or whatever in the afternoon in the garden. Or, you know, there's all those kind of opportunities that we have to see as positives to this whole situation, and see how we want to, how can we create the world that we want to see in the future when this is all over, really, or when the new normal emerges.
It's been really good. I think there's some definite resources that we'll tap into that. Really, really good sort of thing to see. I'm really impressed.
I mean, as a parent, I mean, listening to everything you've just said, it resonates with me massively. You know, I think of my own children, I think if I can develop a core set of skills that I want them to have going into life, resilience is up there with, you know, one of the most important ones. We're all going to face knockbacks. We're all going to face times when things don't go the way we want them to go, and we need to have the ability to be able to move on with that, to be able to, you know, pick ourselves back up again, be able to find another way, and also be able to recognise when someone else isn't, you know, having a great time, someone else isn't being able to do the things they normally would, and how can you help them, how can you support them? So as a parent, you know, and as a teacher, I think resilience is up there with the things that everyone needs to have, that skill that they need to be able to be successful in life.
That's brilliant. Well, I think, Mr. Doyle, you want to stick on the theme of leadership, don't you, and talk a little bit about different leadership styles, leadership formations?
That's it. So we like to give one of our classes a little bit of support in terms of practical examples about something they're studying at the minute. We're going to stick with our Year 12s because it is such an important and overarching unit that they are currently covering, which is psychology and the mind in sport. We thought that we'd have a little bit of a discussion. Now, last week we started on group dynamics, didn't we? We started talking about some different teams in which you can see how the progress from the teams coming together, the forming stage of that, all the way through to performing at the level that the New Zealand All Black rugby team, the Mercedes F1 team, for example, Liverpool at the moment in football are all performing. And leadership plays a massive part in that. The two sections in particular that I want to focus on our discussion, first of all, it's about how leadership in itself can support that process of going from the forming stage, where perhaps the leaders need to be a little bit more dictatorial, autocratic, and really strong on the instruction of how they want to make things happen, through to when they're really performing, they take a bit of a backseat and actually they develop leaders within the group and within the team themselves and sort of delegate to the captains and the senior and experienced members of those teams. So, in terms of that process, a good question, I suppose, to ask would be, at what point do you guys think that the leader at the top, be it a manager or a head coach, do you think that they play the most important role when developing a new team?
I can only really talk from the sports side of things, really. And I look at Tottenham and I go and watch them. Well, I used to go and watch them every week until we were locked down. But they changed manager after a period of time where that manager was in that phase of you had emergent leaders coming through and they were taking lead of the team. And you could see five or six players on the pitch that were really driving that team forward. But as soon as they changed leadership at the top, that's changed again. And you can see that the manager there has taken on that more autocratic approach to things. Very hands-on, very vocal on the sidelines. And some of those players that I thought were like those emergent leaders have kind of regressed a little bit now.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, when you say about sort of taking on that autocratic role, in terms of examples, one of the biggest ones that people usually hark back to was in the newspapers quite some time ago now, but Sir Alex Ferguson was known as a pretty kind of, not dictatorial, but what he said at that club went. He was Manchester United at that point in time. And if you remember the kind of aggressive behaviour sometimes that came out in the press, for example, the incident where the boot went flying and hit David Beckham in the head. And I think that ended up being the start of the end of the career for Manchester United, David Beckham. But in that instance, although that was widely reported, what tended to come out for those that were looking at the psychology of it all was what Alex Ferguson had wanted to happen in that particular game or that run-up of games, tactics, the way that he wanted his team to play. It wasn't translating on the pitch. Those people weren't necessarily listening and understanding whether the communication was there effectively. It wasn't necessarily how he wanted it. And at that point in time, what he said went. So he needed to make sure that at that phase of their learning and their development as a team, that they needed to listen out to his instructions. Whereas there were times where in the press and in interviews, he would very, very much be talking about how he allowed the team to play their own game, enjoy what was going on the pitch, let their skills talk for themselves. And you can see the development and the change in that. And I think that's something where you talk about Tottenham Hotspur, and it happens in so many different clubs with a change at the top. Sometimes, actually, do we allow the groups the time to be able to go through that four-stage process before changes are made, or you get worried about results and getting relegated or not getting into the Champions League? And actually, are people cutting off the point at the point of storming or norming before they get to performing?
I think you can't. You can't separate leadership from culture. They're intrinsic, and I think particularly in a sporting setting, you know, where so many of those teams struggle sometimes with a change of leadership, and that's often seen as the manager. It all comes down to the culture of the team, the culture of the club, and whether that's right for the club. And Sean, like you say, where it's got the backing of the club to do that in terms of results. You know, there's definitely a time for, you know, authoritative leadership. You know, but actually, is that something that can be sustained for a long time? I'm not convinced by that personally, and certainly in my own role as technically, you know, I'm the chief executive of the organisation. We have 40 members of staff and really up to about 70 or 80 members of staff when you include sort of part-time and freelance workers. I don't feel that I'm in charge of every single one of them. My role as a leader within that context is to build a culture where everyone is a leader, and that's certainly the philosophy behind sports leadership and the work that we do in other areas, is that everyone has a role to play, and that's got to be part of a culture that's all pointing in the right direction. You know, there are a myriad of things. I think that the kind of we've got to move away from this perception of leadership as top down. It's absolutely bottom up. You've got to build trust. You've got to empower people. And I think that's true in a business sense. I think it's true in a sporting sense. You know, you've got to match the leadership to the culture of the organisation. And if you don't do that, there's a clash. Certainly when I took over this role, I thought I would come in and everyone would want to get behind me, and that's great. And I changed the culture of the organisation to be more adaptable and a bit more dynamic and a bit more modern. And you know, I quickly realised that not everyone wants change in the same way that I might like it. And actually, that all comes from trust. It all comes from trust and empowerment. And that takes time. And people are all different. People will adapt to that all differently.
That links brilliantly into the second section of that coursework, where you talked about that sort of bottom-up element. The other part of it that our students are going to need to make some links to in the coursework is the difference between a prescribed leader, somebody who maybe comes into an organisation or a team from outside with their own ideas, and an emergent leader. And Mr. Southall, you've alluded to it in terms of Tottenham, and you've said it yourself. Now, Mr. Nash, you were my first head of PE, and actually since then three of the people on that podcast have done the same thing. It's a really good real life example for our students to see how emergent leaders can develop. I mean, tell us about your thoughts from when you were the head of PE at Shenley, and whether you thought it would go this way, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I'm proud of what we've achieved now and a new team leader, but I do go back to that day when you came for interview. And I did have to sleep on the decision to decide whether or not I'd go for Sean or another lady. And sometimes you regret decisions. But, you know, leadership's really important, as you say. And to hear what Richard said about, you know, it's got to come from the bottom up. I fully agree with that. I think about schools in particular, just, you know, to use an example of school. And there is that time sometimes where schools will come in. Someone will come in and be that head, that leader, that autocratic leader. Maybe when that school's in a little bit of danger, you know, not going as well as they'd hoped, so they sort of bring somebody in to prescribe the way in which we're going to work. But then I think the best places, the places that thrive, are the people who can disseminate that leadership to other people, to give people the opportunity to show that they can make that decision. And I know as our own school, we've been through that, where once upon a time that mantra of everyone's a leader was really visible within that school. And it has still stayed there, but things have moved on because that's embedded and it's there. But everyone's got a role to play. Everyone knows that they can make that decision and it'll be supported by somebody, because they've been given those skills and those abilities to be able to do that.
But does it say something about you as a leader? Like, I think about some of those things you just said there. If you were taking on, for example, say England had won the Rugby World Cup and then Eddie Jones just decided to leave, what type of person takes on that job next? Because it can't get any better.
Yeah. I mean, in that situation, it's also the players as well, isn't it? Because had they have won the World Cup, would players have then decided, maybe this is my time to retire,
to finish
at the top? And then maybe you get those younger players coming in that might need a bit more of an autocratic style of leadership to sort of get them on track to let those leaders emerge later on.
If you look at, for example, the same thing with football, you've got Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard, who have almost been put on hold at some point last year as emergent leaders. Jurgen Klopp, very similar to the example that you just said there, Mr. Southall, with Eddie Jones. Jurgen Klopp's going to leave Liverpool at some point. And I think it seems quite obvious at the moment that by going to Rangers and doing his apprenticeship there, Steven Gerrard, as an ex-coach at Liverpool and ex-player, is probably going to be in line for the next one in the job. And the same was true with Frank Lampard going to Derby County. And it's almost like emergent leaders are so important to those particular clubs that they're almost letting them go out and putting them out to the field for a little bit, ready to bring them in later. I did cut you off there, Rich. I do apologise.
No, it's all right. I think Eddie Jones is a really good example, and I think for me, the biggest thing I take from someone like Eddie Jones is the different roles he plays for different people. If you listen to what players say about Eddie Jones, it's very different to what the media say about Eddie Jones. You know, you listen to players and he's very supportive, he's very clear on what he wants out of them, and but he's that bit removed. You know, he's making sure that he's very engaged with what they want from them and the role he wants them to play. So he's very directive in terms of his style to get that kind of consistency in terms of performance. But he then places the onus on the player to actually deliver that. And if they're not delivering that, that's when he makes a decision. But then for the media, I feel like he probably shields some of the players, takes away some of that. You know, he plays a very different game. And I think probably football managers are really key within that. There's definitely So I think in terms of, you know, the question earlier around, you know, if England had won the World Cup, what would have happened? It's all got to do with what are those play, what happens to that playing group? Does that, do you get a whole bunch of players that go out and then come again, which we probably saw after 2003 World Cup, you probably saw after 2015 Rugby World Cup for, from an England perspective of quite a few players chopping and changing. I think I think the biggest thing that, that someone like Eddie Jones has brought in the last few years to rugby has been that, you know, he's not just players that he feels need to be there. He sticks with people that perform and are doing the jobs that he needs, and he's always pushing the boundaries. He's always expecting improvements. But I feel like he places a lot of onus on the players themselves to build that improvement, he's providing the framework. And that's what I think any good leader does, is they adapt their leadership style. You know, there's absolutely there's a time when everyone is an emergent, when everyone's a leader, you know, in their own roles. There are times, and you know, right now is a great example of that. You know, I've had to make decisions about how we run the organisation. You know, to staff members that perhaps we've used a sort of furlough scheme because we're having to finances. You know, sometimes that's the role of a leader, is to make those difficult decisions. For me, I think sport is quite different from everyday world. You know, I think sport is, you know, is a little bit of a microcosm of leadership that doesn't necessarily always paint itself in a great light, you know, because it seems quite authoritative, quite Alex Ferguson in the way that it does things. But actually, I suspect there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on in the background that's about managing the culture of the club, managing the individual needs of those players. You know, some of these players are huge superstars, but they still have the problems that every one of us faces, whether that be personal problems or financial problems or problem or social, you know, problems with family and friends. You know, there's all those things that go into the culture, and that's what leadership has to adapt to. It's adapting to the individual and bringing those individuals on a journey. But so one of the biggest things I think is most important about leadership is actually listening, spending your time and actually listening to the people around you. I certainly know within my organisation, I'm not an expert in anything we do, but I know I've got the right people around me, I've built that team around me, and I trust them and I listen to them. And then sometimes you have to make a decision, and sometimes that decision is going to be between two people who've got conflicting views, and you're there to make that decision. That's the role of a top leader. But actually every one of those people in my organisation, whether it's me as the chief exec, our trustees who challenge everything that I'm telling them, or our directors, our managers, our officers, our customer services team, everyone's got a role to play in the culture of the organisation. So everyone is a leader in their own right and in their own expertise, really.
And you're absolutely right to sort of focus on culture. And sometimes, actually, that's where the prescribed and the emergent leaders, if you look at the other side of it, because we've been quite pro on sort of developing emergent leaders. If the culture is not so good in a team or in an environment in business, then actually there is sometimes a need for a prescribed leader to come in. And the example we've been using, let's stick with it, because Eddie Jones was a prescribed leader at that time. He was somebody that came from the other side of the world, had success elsewhere. And it was Stuart Lancaster prior to that who had actually come through the ranks, hadn't he? The youth coaching, and he'd come through club rugby. I mean, Mr. Nash, I'll pass over to you because you probably know a little bit more about that. But my understanding was that Stuart Lancaster sort of went through club rugby and he was brought in as maybe the next head coach that would take over from the previous manager. And then when it didn't go quite so well, I think it's a disservice to say that they were terrible. But after the Rugby World Cup in 2015, I think they brought in Eddie Jones to somebody to say that the culture's not quite where it needs to be at this point in time. Maybe they've been together too long as a group with that particular leader. And actually now we need somebody with fresh ideas to be able to maybe just reset, go back to that forming stage again and get things right. What do you think, Mr. Nash?
I fully agree with you. I think you've pretty much covered that story there. I mean, ultimately, it was somebody different coming from an outside culture, bringing something different to that team that they hadn't experienced previously. You know, he's coming from a different style of rugby, if you like, and bringing that to the sport over here. But yeah, I mean, you've explained it all there, Sean, so there's not much else I can add to that.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Tennis is another one. Tennis players change coaches quite often, and I think, again, that's more so to bring in that prescribed kind of way, look, new person doing things in a different way, I've got to shake up. It's a different element in an individual sport and individual performance, isn't it, where actually sometimes you really need that new thinking to come in and shake things up a little bit.
I think a big part of leadership is getting those different views. What I absolutely don't want, and I'm talking for myself as a leader within my organisation, I don't want everyone having the same view. I want a little bit of constructive conflict. I want people to bring different perspectives, different views to an argument or a discussion so that we can build a consensus and go forward. And then when we've made a decision, I want everyone to get on board, you know, and everyone to go forward with it and give it their all. You know, we don't want sulkers. We don't want people who are sort of, you know, taking their toys and not playing. You know, we want people to, they might not buy into it, but let's give it our best. You know, we need people that are adaptable in that sense. And that for me is a big part of resilience is, you know, we've not got ideal working situations at the moment, but I'm seeing my team do amazing things with the resources that they've got and the pressures that they have at the moment and turning things around like the modules we spoke about earlier. So for me, it's always about seeking different views. You know, the diversity of a team, the diversity of background is beneficial to building that, the overall dynamics of a group and the overall leadership and culture that you can build. So having people that come with different skills come, and sport is a great example of that. You know, you haven't a very prescribed way. You look at a rugby team, which is sort of more my background than say football, so I'll probably stick with that. You know, you don't want to stick your prop forwards on the wing, but you need both of them to do a job. And you need both of them to know what the outcome of the game is and what the game plan is. And they might not fully agree with it, but they're going to execute it. And so that's kind of where that diversity of views is so important, I think, in across all organisations. And sport is a microcosm of that, which is sometimes a little bit exaggerated in terms of, you know, the role of the manager. I think sometimes that can be overplayed. I think one of the great things about Eddie Jones coming in is that he probably was an outsider. You know, Stuart Lancaster had been through the ranks and was bringing a slightly different philosophy, but he knew those players and knew them quite well and had done various other things. Eddie Jones is someone new, someone transformational who's going to create a difference. And there is that point where any organisation needs a break in someone to come in and do something differently. I think a lot of the success that we saw when Eddie Jones came in was probably built on foundations that Stuart Lancaster made, but actually coming in and making some tweaks and changes here and there, a slight different way in which people worked, has seen a response from the players. And you so often see that with football, where, you know, there is this kind of, you know, a manager goes, a new player comes in, and there is an immediate response from players. And that's all to do with them performing, them trying to impress. And what we need to try and foster in any organisation is that people want to do that naturally. How do they keep going? But it's difficult to sort of exclude performance on the pitch, performance in a sports setting, and ignore anything else that might be going on in their life. We all have bad days in a work setting. We all have bad days at home. That's true for everybody. And that's what that resilience piece is about. It's about recognising you have bad days, but how are you going to bounce back from it? How are you going to take control? How are you going to use the best of your abilities to make the best of this situation? And that's kind of, I think that's where sport is such an interesting microcosm of society and culture at large, really.
Can I just ask you, Rich, as well? So, with everything that's been going on, have you found your leadership style changing because you're working from home now? And do you think you'll change anything moving forward?
I think there's a load of operational stuff that's really boring that I wouldn't that will probably change going forward. You know, for me, it's been really, but in a practical sense, for me, it's been really nice to be home a little bit more. I so often feel that my house, you know, the thing that I'm working for is the thing I sleep in and then leave. And slowing down a little bit, you know, actually, you know, working 10, 15 hours a day and all over the place to make meetings and try and be everywhere, I think actually slowing down a bit has been useful. We've been doing, there's this kind of looking at other sectors and for a number of years, particularly in, say, digital world, they use a thing called Agile Scrum kind of project management methodology, which rather than having endless meetings that last for hours and doesn't really get everything happening, actually a 10 or 15 minute update can be as useful but more frequently. So actually, as a leadership team, we've got a small leadership team of four people. As we've been responding to the crisis, we've changed our management of that. We've been looking at we would normally, under normal circumstances, once every 2 weeks, we would have a meeting where we'd all be in the same place and we'd sit there for 3 or 4 hours and talk about all the challenges and issues that we've had over the past 2 weeks and the challenges we've got in the next 2 weeks. Actually, we've been doing that in a 15-minute catch-up every morning. Mm. So, you know, every morning, 9 a.m, first thing, 15 minutes, okay, what's everyone got on? Any blockers? Who needs what? Let's crack on. So it's a lot more active. And I think they're the certain things that we'll certainly try and take away a little bit more. And I think my role in them has been a bit more about coordinating them and sort of keeping people focused rather than sort of exploring all these other options. So there's definitely some positives we'll take out of this and definitely some changes to working practices. Whether there'll be a change to my leadership style, I don't know. I'm not sure I've got much of a style anyway, so probably a better question for my team than anything else. But I think there'll definitely be, I think what this has provided us with, and this comes back to the resilience piece, is recognising that out of adversity you can make positives. You can see that actually there are different ways of working that we can use beneficially. And I think they're certainly practices that we'll look to help people have better. I don't really agree with the term work-life balance. I don't think that exists anymore. It's just about having this life balance. You know, it's about actually getting the right kind of level of interaction with staff. Yes, you've got to pay the bills, you've got to have a job and all those kind of things. But actually, you know, allowing people a bit more flexibility, which has kind of been the culture I've been trying to generate for the past 4 or 5 years that I've been a sports leader anyway. But actually, this has forced us to make that change and forced everyone else to make that change rapidly. So actually, when we're looking at coming to some sort of normal, one of the first things I'm going to be saying to my team across the whole organisation is, what was good about that? What do you want to keep? What don't you want to go back to?
And that's the reflective nature of a facilitator, isn't it? Almost linking it into that performing side of things.
So. Yeah, and there's going to be some of those adaptations that we can't make for practical reasons. But how can we make 80% of them? You know, how can we find that people actually go, do you know what? Actually, I really enjoyed working from home when I want to. You know, so we might be able to have a smaller office space, but a more flexible office space. You know, real practical adaptations that we can make as a result of that. But I think that's kind of been my style for a long time anyway. So it's kind of listening. As I said, it's kind of trying to listen to what people are saying around you. And that's kind of, for me, the critical role of a leader is trying to facilitate everyone else to be a leader.
And I think that's the biggest takeaway for the students who are going to be embarking on this piece of coursework, isn't it? It's about being able to make the links in between the theory. So we've spoken today about the difference between an emergent and a prescribed leader, but we've looked at both sides of the coin. There's an evaluation to be had there, positives and negatives on each side. But we've also linked in to very key skills that they would have looked at in one of their previous units and learning AMA about the personality, motivation and confidence and all those kinds of elements that makes up the psychology of sport, and linking back to key skills that you can develop, such as being able to listen a little bit more, to become a little bit more of a democratic style of leader and develop different teams. I think the key thing, again, we've provided some examples with regard to Eddie Jones and the rugby, tennis, football and things like that as well, the students can use in their coursework. But the biggest thing is to make sure that they link the different sections that we're talking about here. It's almost a conversational style that we're looking for them. But within academic writing, asking them to sort of challenge some of the leadership that they see on the news and when they watch sport, but also, and this is the key thing, linking it to real life is important. It is okay to be able to bring in the kind of conversation, Rich, that you've given to us today about real life business, what students in the sports industry may see in future when they go into that in terms of leadership, but also being able to bring it in and use it when they're trying to explain a theory, a topic or an example as well. So all round, gents, it's been fantastic and really, really useful for that piece of work.
Yeah, I think that's been great. Rich, thanks so much for coming on, letting us pick your brains about what you do. That's been really useful.
More than welcome. I really enjoyed it anytime.
Fantastic.
We'll have a think about what we're going to cover next week. And I suppose the best thing to do is say we'll see you guys next week.
Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you. See you later.